Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the Dogs Program. We are the Dogs, the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools. We are here every Saturday to defend and promote public education. That is education that is public in purpose and outcome. Above all, it is public in access, open to all children, teachers, and employees. It is publicly owned and controlled, and it's the only education system that can be publicly accountable. Therefore, we believe it is the only education system that should be publicly funded. We're all too aware that the neoliberal argument for choice has created a parasitic private sector leeching resources from what once was a gold standard public education system, which leads us into this week's Dogs press release. And a reminder that all of our press releases and the articles they contain are available at the Dogs website at www.adogs.info. www.adogs.info. Dogs press release number 1071. Do we strengthen public education or dismantle its core principles? Public education, like democracy, is at a crossroads throughout the Western world. In Australia, the Labor government's quest for a fairer education system in 1973 had the Labor Party courting the Catholic vote, initiating a needs policy. This quickly became a greeds policy, with the private sector fleecing both taxpayers and parents in the name of religious freedom. And what is the result 50 years later? One of the most segregated school systems in the OECD, with only 62%, down from 78% in 1977, attending public schools. A system which is failing in its purpose of achieving academic results, falling behind in the OECD comparison stakes. A system which is costing the taxpayer to duplicate school facilities on the basis of class, creed, colour, and any other criteria invented by latter-day culture warriors. An underfunded public system and an overfed religious private sector. Some very genuine public school supporters still believe that the way forward is to compromise with supporters of parental choice. Clerical control of property, curriculum and taxpayer funds, entanglement of religion with the state, and discrimination against children, parents, teachers, and school employees on the basis of class, creed, and, in these latter days, sexual status. Those hoping for some compromise with those who have never compromised are now promoting a system of full public funding for private schools on the provision that they do not discriminate in their enrolment policies. Trevor Cobalt from Save Our Schools, while still hoping against hope for a needs policy along the lines of the 2011 Gonski report, has realised that the central question is not whether Australia needs a fairer education system. It unquestionably does. The real question is whether we strengthen public education or dismantle its core principles. Dogs recognised the importance of his return to the basics of a definition of the essentials of public education, and its definition is in his latest report, a summary of which is reproduced now. We await the realisation that public education cannot survive and flourish unless and until it is the only system which is publicly funded. The private religious system is and has proved itself to be parasitic upon the public system. If the parasite is favoured with nourishment, the host declines and dies. But here is where Trevor Cobalt from Save Our Schools is at. I'll pass you over to Andy to read Trevor Cobalt's report.
Don't destroy public education in the name of reform. Trevor Cobalt, June the 10th. The following is a summary of a research paper by Save Our Schools. The full paper can be downloaded at their website. Australia's education debate is at a dangerous turning point. In the pursuit of greater equity, some commentators propose that private schools receive full taxpayer funding, provided they do not charge fees and relax some enrolment restrictions. Save Our Schools completely rejects this proposal as a chimera that also jettisons the foundation principles of public education. The central question is not whether Australia needs a fairer education system. It unquestionably does. The real question is whether we strengthen public education or dismantle its core principles. Save Our Schools rejects full taxpayer funding of private schools for two reasons. One, it abrogates key principles of public education, and two, religious and private school organisations are very unlikely to give up their resource advantage over public schools and their special funding privileges. Australia's public schools were founded on three enduring principles. They are secular, non-discriminatory, and free. These principles matter because public education is not simply another provider in a marketplace. Public schools are civic institutions designed to educate all children, regardless of income, religion, ethnicity, ability, sexuality, or family background. The proposal to fully fund private religious schools fundamentally blurs that distinction. Even if private schools do not charge fees, they would still retain what advocates call their special ethos. In practice, this means continuing religious instruction and observance, continuing faith-based student enrolment and staff recruitment, and preserving exemptions from anti-discrimination laws. These schools would remain non-secular and discriminatory within the public system. Secular and non-discriminatory public education plays a critical role in ensuring children from diverse backgrounds learn together. This is particularly important in an increasingly multicultural Australia. It is a fact that government funding of private schools currently supports discrimination in employment and enrolments, as well as religious curriculum and values. However, this is not a reason to continue or extend government funding of such practices. It is a reason to look for an alternative method to fund private schools. Australia has one of the most socially segregated education systems in the developed world. Advantaged families increasingly cluster in overfunded private schools, while disadvantaged students are concentrated in underfunded public schools. But absorbing private religious systems into a full taxpayer-funded quasi-public model while allowing them to retain private privileges is not the way to reduce social segregation. Attracting more disadvantaged students to private schools by making them free as a way to encourage a more balanced social profile in private schools is a bizarre way to reduce social segregation. The better solution is to properly fund the schools that already educate the overwhelming majority of disadvantaged children, public schools. Full funding of public schools will help to retain more advantaged students in public schools. It also has the advantage of maintaining the integrity of the principles of public education. For years, governments have claimed to support needs-based funding under the Gonski framework, yet public schools remain billions of dollars short of their schooling resource standard, the SRS, while private schools are funded above their SRS and enjoy other substantial funding advantages. The consequences are obvious in classrooms across the country: teacher shortages, inadequate specialist support, deteriorating infrastructure, and widening achievement gaps between rich and poor students. Money alone will not solve every educational challenge, but sustained huge underfunding guarantees failure for disadvantaged students. Supporters of full taxpayer funding for private schools argue that removing fees would reduce inequality and improve access. But this argument ignores a crucial reality. Many private systems are highly unlikely to surrender the financial and structural privileges they currently enjoy. Catholic and independent school systems currently benefit from a significant resource advantage over public schools across Australia and in nearly every state and territory, courtesy of generous government funding. In 2024, total income per student in Catholic schools was $1,699 more than in public schools and $8,274 more in the case of independent schools. These are large advantages to surrender. If private schools agree not to charge fees in order to be fully funded by the taxpayer, they would be funded on the same needs-based model as public schools. As a result, they could even end up with less income per student than public schools for as long as they fail to attract the same proportion of disadvantaged students as in public schools. This would occur because the higher funding loadings would apply to a smaller proportion of disadvantaged students than in public schools. Currently, students from low socio-educationally advantaged families comprise a much larger proportion of public school enrolments than in private schools. In 2023, 31% of students in public schools were in the lowest SEA quartile, compared with 16% in Catholic schools and 11% in independent schools. It would take years, even decades, of not charging fees for the demographic profile of private schools to become similar to that of public schools, and during this time, they would receive less government funding per student, and therefore less income per student, than public schools. It would be a huge gamble by Catholic and other private schools that they would ever gain so many higher funded disadvantaged students as to have the same proportion of disadvantaged students as public schools. Another privilege for several private school systems is that they receive block funding by government that allows diverted funding intended for less advantaged schools towards wealthier schools in order to maintain market share with limited transparency, as documented by official audits and reviews. They also receive additional special purpose funding not available to public schools, such as the $1 billion slush fund called the Choice and Affordability Fund. Why would these systems voluntarily abandon funding arrangements that have served them so well? There is also a deeper issue at stake. What exactly makes a school public? Public schools are not merely schools funded by taxpayers. They are publicly owned, publicly governed, and publicly accountable institutions operating under universal social obligations. Under proposals for fully funded private religious schools, institutions would remain privately owned and privately operated while continuing to exercise selective rights over curriculum, staffing, and culture. In this case, public schools would then become public in name only because part of the system would not operate in accordance with the principles of public education. The way to reduce inequity is to strengthen the public system that serves everyone. That means implementing a genuine needs-based Gonski Plus funding model with substantially higher support for disadvantaged students and schools. It means ending the accounting tricks that defraud public schools, ending the special deals that advantage private schools, and limiting their taxpayer funding of private schools to filling any gap between private income and the community resource standard. Such a model should be supported by a system of regular review of progress in reducing the gap in school outcomes between advantaged and disadvantaged students. The current Closing the Gap report between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people provides a model to follow in keeping the pressure on governments to increase equity in school outcomes. There is understandable frustration among public education families, organisations and advocates. Progress on fully funding public schools and increasing equity has been too slow. But abandoning the principles of public education is not reform, it is surrender. Australia should not destroy public education in order to save it. It is important to keep perspective and not be overcome by despair at the slow progress. Much has been achieved. 15 years ago, choice was the dominant paradigm in school funding. That has changed dramatically. Equity in education and needs-based funding are now dominant themes. The basic Gonski model is not in question. The coalition and private school organisations dare not openly challenge it. The real challenge is the fight for truly fully funded public schools to properly support the learning of disadvantaged students and rebuild confidence in the one education system designed to serve every Australian child. That is the reform agenda Australia actually needs. The author thanks SOS colleagues Professor Ian Morgan and Grant Battersby for their helpful comments and suggestions on drafts of this paper. Back to you.
Thanks for that, Andy. Now let's have a little bit of a break. We'll be back with more dogs after this.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Welcome back to the Dogs program. This is the Defence of Government Schools program here on 3CR. Now I'm going to pass you over to Maddie, who has an interesting article about the advantages that the human brain has over AI. Over to you, Maddie.
This article says, study reveals the brain advantages that AI still can't match. AI can write essays, generate images, and sift through mountains of information in seconds. But despite its remarkable capabilities, researchers say one of the most powerful ingredients of human intelligence remains frustratingly difficult to replicate: our ability to adapt, learn from experience, and make sense of an ever-changing world. The challenge was the focus of a recent international webinar led by CQ University's Head of Educational Neuroscience, Professor Ken Purnell. Speaking to academics and business leaders from around the world, including Silicon Valley, Purnell explored how insights from neuroscience are helping shape the next generation of AI, while highlighting the uniquely human qualities that machines have yet to master. People often think intelligence is about how much information can be stored or processed, but neuroscience tells us something different, Professor Purnell said in a media release published by CQ University this week. The real power of the human brain lies in its ability to adapt, learn from experience, and continually reshape itself in response to the world around it. Professor Purnell explained that the human brain contains around 86 billion neurons, each forming thousands of connections with others. More important than the number of neurons, however, is the constantly evolving network of connections between them. Unlike a filing cabinet that stores information in fixed locations, the brain builds interconnected networks of meaning that are continually shaped and reshaped by experience, he said. This neuroplasticity allows us to learn, adapt, and respond to changing circumstances throughout our lives. The webinar explored the growing links between neuroscience and artificial intelligence, highlighting how many modern AI systems already draw inspiration from the brain. Concepts such as artificial neural networks, predictive processing, and attention mechanisms all have roots in our understanding of how the brain processes information and makes sense of the world. Professor Purnell said both brains and AI systems rely on prediction, using past information to anticipate what is likely to happen next. However, important differences remain. The human brain doesn't simply process information, it experiences the world, he said. Our thinking is shaped by emotion, context, relationships, and lived experience. AI can identify patterns, but it doesn't possess the rich personal experiences that influence human decision-making and learning. Professor Purnell said neuroscience also reveals that human memory is a reconstructive rather than a reproductive process. We don't replay memories like a video recording. We rebuild them each time, influenced by meaning, context, and emotion. That flexibility is a fundamental part of human intelligence. As researchers continue to develop new forms of AI, including neuromorphic computing and advanced learning systems inspired by the brain, Professor Purnell believes neuroscience will play an increasingly important role in shaping future technologies.
Thanks for that, Maddie. And now I'm going to pass you over to Andy, who has another interesting article about why more tech isn't the answer. Over to you, Andy.
Why more tech won't improve digital literacy outcomes. This is from The Educator, written by Brett Hennebury, published on the 10th of June. In May, new data revealed Australian students' ICT literacy has dropped to its lowest point since testing began in 2005, despite young people being more digitally immersed than any generation before them. The data from the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority, ACARA, found that just half, 50% of Year 6 students attained the proficient standard, a decline from 55% in 2022, and is also lower than the national percentages observed in 2011. For Year 10 students, a mere 37% attained the proficient standard, which is the lowest percentage observed since the assessment's inception. Federal Education Minister Jason Clare has tasked the Australian Education Research Organisation, AERO, with investigating the results. In an interview with The Educator, AERO CEO Dr. Jenny Donovan said the last two decades have shown that access to technology does not translate into capability. Students can become familiar with digital tools very quickly, but without deliberate instruction, that familiarity doesn't develop into the skills needed to evaluate information, think critically, or solve problems, Dr. Donovan told The Educator. While encouraging more purposeful use of technology is important, the underlying issue is how these skills are taught. Dr. Donovan pointed out that learning doesn't occur through exposure alone. It requires explicit structured teaching that builds knowledge step by step with practice and feedback. For example, showing a student how to search online is different from teaching them how to assess the credibility of what they find, she explained. Those higher order capabilities need to be taught deliberately if students are to move beyond passive use, and they also rely upon students having access to a knowledge-rich curriculum that equips them with the information on which to base their thinking or reasoning. Dr. Donovan said the challenge now for schools is not just shifting students from passive to active digital use, but ensuring that this shift is grounded in what educators know about how young people learn. Without that, new technologies, including AI, risk reinforcing superficial engagement rather than enhancing knowledge, skills, and learning. Aero welcomes the opportunity to conduct further research into what is driving these results and attempt to answer some of the questions about what tools work, for which students, and under what conditions. When asked what might Aero's investigation process look like in terms of the scale and scope of the research it will be undertaking, Dr. Donovan said the work will draw on existing evidence while exploring where AI can deliver meaningful impact. This project will build upon some of Aero's previous work, such as our Strengthening the Evidence on How Gen AI Can Improve Teaching and Learning discussion paper released in 2024, she said. The potential is real, but so are the gaps in what we know. Any tool that genuinely improves outcomes must build on what we already understand about effective teaching, fit practically into how schools work, and reach the students who need it most.
Thanks for that, Andy. And now I've got an interesting article for you from The Guardian. This article is by Krishani Danji, titled, One in Four Humanities Students in Australia to Take More Than 25 Years to Pay Off Student Loans, Treasury Finds. The Job Ready Graduates Program, or JRG, will also leave almost two-thirds of humanities and creative arts students with debts exceeding $50,000. One in four humanities students will take more than 25 years to fully repay their student loans because of Morrison government changes to university fees, newly public treasury modelling reveals. The Job Ready Graduates Program, introduced in 2021 under the former Prime Minister Scott Morrison, will also leave almost two-thirds of humanities and creative arts students saddled with debts exceeding $50,000. Treasury also found median payment times for creative arts graduates increasing from 14 to 17 years because of the scheme, which critics point out has been in place longer under Labor than under the last coalition government. The scheme was introduced to incentivize students to take degrees such as science, nursing, education, and IT, and disincentivize humanities, law, and creative arts degrees by significantly increasing fees. The university sector has said the scheme has not changed students' choices. The modelling, released to Guardian Australia under Freedom of Information rules, was prepared in May 2025. It shows that the number of graduates leaving university with debts under $20,000 has doubled, and the number of students with debts over $50,000 has increased by 70%, and humanities students are set to pay off their debts into their 40s. The Independent Senator David Pocock said the findings were deeply concerning and called on the government to urgently reform the scheme. The unfair burden of higher student debt in lower income professions will massively impact graduates' lives, making it even harder to buy a home, start a family, or travel, he said. If the Albanese government is serious about doing more on intergenerational equity, then reforming the JRG has to be an urgent priority. JRG has now been in place for longer under the Albanese government than the Morrison government. More students are also likely to never repay their debt to the government, according to the data. It states that students in lower earning fields have worse repayment prospects, meaning the government receives less revenue despite the increased debt that students have accrued. It estimates that between a JRG and pre-JRG scenario, total university debt increases by $800 million, but the government can only expect half of that to be repaid. The Education Minister Jason Clare has repeatedly said the scheme has been an abject failure in its intention to discourage people from studying arts degrees, and that the government is taking reform of the university sector one step at a time. In February, the government passed legislation to establish the Australian Tertiary Education Commission, ATEC, which would be the body making recommendations to Clare on reforming the scheme. But under Labor's legislation, the body will not be required to consider student contributions and makes no explicit mention of JRG. The government has also rejected a Greens amendment that would have given ATEC a remit to reform the scheme. Western Sydney University Vice Chancellor George Williams said the modelling shows the issue is a point of concern for the government and lays bare the deep unfairness of student fees. This clearly indicates a need for policy reform, Williams said. It identifies deep systemic problems within the student fee structure, particularly the fact that we now have people carrying debt for such a large part of their lifetimes, and they are people who often earn the lowest graduate salaries. I've seen a lot of anecdotal evidence about how long it takes and what it means to carry debt for potentially a lifetime. But this is now clear based on their modelling. Williams said he was concerned that $50,000 arts degrees could now remain in place until 2028 or beyond. We haven't got any indication from the government yet for reform, and clearly what we would like is a timetable and clarity about how long this will take to fix. Indeed. And now it's time to go overseas with Jeff. What have you got for us today, Jeff?
Good afternoon, listeners. The first story is going to come from Scotland. This is from Educational International, which is an international union of teachers. It doesn't give an author, it's an institution, and it just publishes under its own name. This is dated from the 15th of June, 26th, and it is titled, Scotland, Education Union Leaders Stress the Power and Vital Importance of Global Solidarity. And it begins, the transformative power and critical role of global union solidarity featured prominently at the 180th Annual General Meeting of the Educational Institute of Scotland, EIS, which took place on 4th to 6th of June in Dundee. Founded in 1847, the EIS is the largest teaching and education union in Scotland and one of the oldest unions in the world. It brings together 65,000 members and represents the overwhelming majority of teachers and lecturers across the nation. In his final address to the annual general meeting, outgoing President Adam Sutcliffe highlighted the union's engagement in solidarity actions around the world, noting that trade union solidarity does not begin and end at the school gates. It extends to our brothers and sisters throughout Scotland, to those across the UK and also on the island of Ireland, but more importantly, it is truly international. It is global. Standing with teachers and students in Palestine is a subheading. Sutcliffe was part of the EI Solidarity mission to Palestine, which was detained and interrogated for hours at the Israel-Jordan border before being barred from entering the country by Israeli officials in January. The high-level delegation consisted of union leaders from around the world who had supported a training program for Palestinian teachers. Their intent was to visit EI member organization, the General Union of Palestinian Teachers, to mark the International Day of Education, attend the graduation ceremony, and learn about the situation of colleagues in Gaza and the West Bank. Reflecting on the experience, Sutcliffe noted that the powerlessness and injustice felt in those moments were just a fraction of what Palestinians face every day. Whilst I don't want to minimise the issues we face in our day-to-day as trade unionists, we must also keep in mind our brothers, sisters and non-binary siblings across the world, whose day-to-day may indeed involve serious risk to life, Sutcliffe stressed. Addressing the annual general meeting, EI General Secretary David Edwards thanked Sutcliffe and the EIS for their continued solidarity and emphasised its value for teachers in Palestine. Ironically, their fear of teachers standing in solidarity with Palestinian teachers and students and attempts to intimidate, isolate or silence us only strengthened our collective determination to continue supporting our brothers and sisters and to amplify the voices of those who, despite a genocidal war and military occupation, continue to teach and to build hope for future generations, Edwards noted. Subheading, Peace is Union Business. Sutcliffe reaffirmed his organisation's commitment to the global union movement, its people and its values. We must extend our trade union solidarity and human solidarity to teachers, lecturers and all workers, not only in Palestine, Ukraine, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Lebanon, Myanmar and Cuba, to name a few, but also to wherever there is conflict, unrest and authoritarianism. Drawing attention to the conflicts that do not make the headlines, Sutcliffe shared the heartbreaking story of Mr. Fon, a teacher from Cameroon who had supported Sutcliffe during the 2 years he spent teaching English in the West African country. Mr. Fon passed away a few years ago from complications related to starvation. The crisis in his country led to the closure of 80% of public schools and therefore the non-payment of salaries by the Cameroonian government. In the face of such injustice, it's imperative to remember that none of us can truly be free to live our lives in peace and comfort until we're all free to live our lives in peace and comfort, Sutcliffe concluded. Edwards echoed this call for solidarity. His speech provided a sharp analysis of the state of the world and the ways in which the EI is harnessing solidarity and building union power to defend the teaching profession, public education, people and planet. Edwards also reiterated Education International's fierce commitment to peace, democracy and human dignity. Peace must be union business because we know at the centre of every conflict we witness is also an assault on education. Schools are bombed, teachers displaced, children traumatised, entire communities fall apart. Global solidarity supports education communities in crisis contexts, and it's instrumental in the release of imprisoned unionists, and it keeps hope alive in the most challenging circumstances. Every time a teacher creates a safe classroom, every time a student learns to think critically instead of hate reflexively, every time a community invests in a school instead of a weapon, we expand the territory of peace on this planet, the EI General Secretary concluded. And that's the end of that article. I thought it was pertinent. And we're going to the next one, which is continuing this theme. This is from The Guardian. It's by Sarah Johnson, and it was also from Monday, the 15th of June, 26. And its title is Violent Attacks on Schools, Pupils and Staff Around the World Are Up by 40%, says a study. And it begins, cases reported in 83 countries with at least 10,600 students and staff killed, injured or abducted or arrested, GCPEA says. It says, attacks on education globally have surged by 40% with more than 8,556 recorded incidents and 10,600 students and staff killed, injured, abducted, arrested or otherwise harmed in 2024 and 25, according to new research. Attacks were reported in 83 countries, with the highest incidences recorded in Colombia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Haiti, Palestine and Ukraine. Ukraine experienced about 900 attacks on schools, while Palestine saw at least 2,400 attacks on students and staff, the report from the Global Coalition to Protect Education from Attack, GCPEA, said. Cases of military forces or armed groups occupying schools or universities nearly doubled, 91%, from the previous 2 years, with 1,912 recorded cases, according to the study published on Monday. Lisa Chung Bender, director of the GCPEA, said the report's findings sounded the alarm about the threat to education. They are a warning that the global norms that once protected children are collapsing, she said. A warning that the world is drifting towards a place where even the youngest are no longer off limits. And a warning that if we do not hold the line now, we may never get it back. The highest numbers of people who fell victim to attacks on education were in Myanmar, Nigeria, Yemen and Cameroon, where more than 1,700 students and staff in total were killed or injured. In Nigeria, more than 700 students and staff were reportedly kidnapped, while in Myanmar, at least 80 students and staff were killed and about 240 were injured. Professor Tiendra
Ferrali, Professor of Education, Conflict and Peace at University College in London, said it's heartbreaking to see numbers are rising. It's the same pattern every year. In my view, this is more systematic rather than episodic, and attacks are increasingly strategic. He added, behind these numbers are the children who no longer see schools as a place of safety. It's not just education that is lost, it's safety, futures and trust in educational institutions. In at least 11 countries, women and girls were targeted because of their gender, the report found. One example in Nigeria on the 17th of November 2025, gunmen attacked a girls' boarding school, killing the vice principal and abducting 25 female pupils. Students with disabilities who were already faced significant obstacles to accessing education were also affected. On the 11th of September 25 in Lebanon, sources said an Israeli military carried out a controlled detonation to destroy a school for children with special needs. The use of high explosives, including drone-borne munitions, featured frequently in the attacks on schools, resulting in extensive casualties, damage to infrastructure, and forcing many institutions to close. Kieran King from the charity War Child UK said attacks on education were a grave violation of international law, such as the Geneva Conventions. The reality is that since 2010, we have seen a 60% increase in children living in conflict, he said. Over the same period, we've seen grave violations against children, including attacks on education, increased by 373%. King added that the states acting without fear of sanction and aid cuts were worsening the situation. We see this weakening multilateral system and political impunity for war crimes more broadly, he said. The inevitable result is that a documented surge in disregard for international humanitarian law. The aid cuts that we've seen from the US, but also the UK and others, have led to significant amounts of funding for support force of humanitarian action being removed from the sector. GCPEA's Chung Bender insisted that the attacks were preventable. However, we need states to end military use of schools, strengthen legal protection and accountability for attacks on education, and invest in monitoring, reporting and early warning systems, she said. The figures come as the number of conflicts between states has reached the highest level since the Second World War. Uppsala University's conflict data program registered 65 conflicts during the 2025 to 2013, which were classified as wars, which meant that they had caused at least 1,000 battle-related deaths in a calendar year. This is the highest number since 1992. Number of fatalities has also increased sharply during the year among combatants and civilians. In all, more than 244,000 people were killed in organised violence in 2025, which makes it the second most bloody year since genocide in Rwanda in 1994. That's the article. It's finished. If people would like to Google Ukraine's underground schools, check out how the Ukraine is literally having to put its school children underground in order to protect them, for something like 900 schools have been so far bombed by the Russians with precision weapons, by the way. So they're literally targeting them to cause terror. With that terribly serious news, I'm going to pass this back to you all, and apart from those things to cogitate on, I wish you well for the weekend. Cheerio.
Thanks so much for that, Jeff. Now it's time for a quick break. We'll be back with more dogs after this.
Have you heard about the news that's come out of the NT?
What news? Fires, floods, chicken flu, what?
No, the payouts.
Payouts?
Compensation for what you went through.
No.
Well, I reckon you should go for it. You deserve every cent and more. I'll back you. You know it.
Oh, sis, you're the best.
Yes, I am.
If you are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander and were removed from family or community in the Northern Territory before 1 July 1978 or in the ACT or Jervis Bay before 11th of May 1989, you may be eligible for the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme. If you know of a family member who was removed but passed away after the scheme was announced on the 5th of August 2001, you may be eligible to apply for redress for them. Call Link Up Victoria, VACA, on 037 002 3700 and leave a message for a callback or contact the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme on 1800 566 111.
A 3CR supporter.
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant, and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Welcome back to the DOGS program, the Defence of Government Schools program. And now we are in the home stretch and our favourite part of the program, the good news stories. First up, I've got an article here by Ralph Jackman that leads into our great state school. He writes, "A job that changed me. I was teaching in a juvenile detention centre when a repeat offender's poetry moved me to tears. On my first day, I was terrified, but I quickly came to realise these young people weren't irredeemably bad. Those who can't teach is the most unjust professional put down. Unfortunately, it was true in my case. I'd lived a childhood dream for 25 years as a sports reporter and producer in Australia, London, and New York. When I moved back to Melbourne from the United States with my family in 2017, I started a media production company with an old friend. Had it been successful, I never would have entered a classroom again. But our company went belly up after 18 months. I was 51, with two young kids and a hefty mortgage. My wife suggested it might be time to revisit the idea of teaching. I'd thought about teaching for decades. When we lived in New York, I volunteered at a school called Harlem Village Academies. I helped high school students from disadvantaged backgrounds write their college entrance essays. On the back of this experience and my wife's advice, I went back to university for 2 years to retrain as a high school teacher. I anticipated a job teaching history in a mainstream Melbourne school. But my first interview was with the school in the maximum security Parkville Youth Justice Precinct. My interviewers spoke with passion about the school and its mission, and something clicked. I left wanting to be part of the team. On my first day, I was terrified. The first thing a young person said to me was, 'I'm going to stab you. Yeah, dot, dot, dot.' Can't say that on radio. Fortunately, the threat came from a locked cell. The sizable knot in my stomach grew even larger when we were addressed by the precinct's general manager later that morning. Unfortunately, things have been very unsettled in the precinct. We've got a number of staff and young people recovering from serious facial fractures. Things didn't improve in my first class. I thought we'd start with poetry, I said to half a dozen 15-year-old boys. They responded with a chorus of dead haps and bugger that. Class over. One boy came to my afternoon class. Jimmy, not his real name, was 15. My supervisor had told me Jimmy struggled with basic literacy. She suggested he may enjoy being read to. When Jimmy arrived for class, he paced from one end of the room to the other, kicking the door and yelling out the window to passers-by. He eventually sat down, and I pulled up a chair opposite him. I offered to read to him, showing him a book called Horrid Henry, and told him I'd been reading it with my daughter. For the first time, Jimmy sat dead still and looked me in the eye. 'You read? With your daughter?' he asked. 'Yes,' I said. I got halfway through the first sentence when Jimmy stopped me. 'You read with your daughter.' The concept seemed beyond his comprehension. 'How old's your daughter?' Jimmy asked. 8. Can she read? 'Yes, she can.' 'I really want to learn to read,' Jimmy said. Keep it together, I told myself. How could a 15-year-old be adept at stealing cars, yet not be able to read the words "Education State" on its number plate? This moment was day one confirmation that I'd made the right decision in switching to teaching. I worked with Jimmy on his reading in the weeks that followed. Then he suddenly left Parkville and I didn't see him again. During my second year at the school, we received an email from Jimmy's social worker. "Jimmy's doing really well in the community," it read. "He's also continuing to make great progress with his reading." When I started at Parkville, I expected upturned desks, thrown chairs, verbal abuse, and violent threats. There would be a bit of all of that, but they weren't the moments that made the biggest impression. The class with Jimmy was the first of many. There was the student who took his campaign for a precinct library all the way to the Victorian Education Minister, and the repeat offender whose poetry nearly moved me to tears. These young people, I quickly realised, weren't irredeemably bad. They were like other teenagers, the main difference being that many of them had childhoods few of us could imagine. I had two incredible years at Parkville before resigning due to ill health. Back when I was interviewing my cricketing heroes or walking the fairways of the home of golf, St. Andrews, alongside Tiger Woods, I had to pinch myself. But the satisfactions of teaching goes deeper. Making a late career change reignited my passion for work, and I wish I'd done it sooner. And that's an excerpt from Ralph Jackman's memoir, Detention, A Rookie Teacher, The Toughest Prison School in Australia. And now that leads us into this week's Great State School of the Week. Over to you, Andy.
And this week's Great State School of the Week is Parkville College. Parkville College is a specialist Victorian government school that provides education to students who are or have been detained in custody, a secure care setting, or transitioning from these settings. Working in collaboration with the Department of Justice and Community Safety and the Department of Families, Fairness and Housing, we deliver education across four diverse campuses throughout Victoria. Parkville College operates year-round and caters to some of the most vulnerable students in the state. Providing education to students with diverse learning goals and abilities, Parkville College individually tailors education to the student to give them the greatest successes. Students become enrolled if they are detained in a Youth Justice Centre or a Secure Care Service, SCS, within Victoria. While enrolment numbers fluctuate daily, the school can provide education to up to 300 students on any given day. Under the Department of Education and Training's Parent Payments Policy, Victorian government schools are required to provide transparent information to their school community on voluntary parent carer contributions. Parkville College does not request any payments or contributions, and all services are provided at no cost to parents, carers. Parkville College prides itself on attracting staff that are unique in their adaptive and responsive ways of teaching. Our school are continually developing and tailoring their teaching to each individual student. The college is a registered government school teaching all levels of education from early primary years through to secondary and beyond. We specialise in VCE, VCAL and VET and provide dedicated support for students in their transition to other pathways, whether that be educational or vocational. All students have individualised student plans to support them through their journey at Parkville College. Parkville College prides itself on delivering education in a different environment, with our central focus being to support the students towards developing themselves and changing their trajectory. Our teachers model high impact engagement strategies, HIES, and utilise high impact teaching strategies, HITS, within a trauma-informed and culturally responsive pedagogy. Students are supported and encouraged to grow as individuals and be the best versions of themselves. Our history. In October 2010, the Victorian Ombudsman's report made a series of recommendations to improve conditions in the state's youth custodial system. The report criticised the lack of education available to children and young people in detention, and changes to the precinct commenced in alignment with the report's recommendations. Brendan Murray had a vision to provide education to Victoria's youth that were a part of the youth justice system, detained in custody, or in the secure welfare environment. He joined forces with Maddie Witter as literacy consultant and pitched the concept of Parkville College operating within the youth justice system to the Victorian state government. On the 31st of July 2012, the Minister for Education formally established Parkville College. With operation to commence on the 30th of January 2013 across both the Parkville Youth Justice Precinct and the Malmesbury Youth Justice Precinct, which soon became known as Parkville College, Parkville and Malmesbury campuses. Parkville College would operate for 52 weeks of the year. Parkville College also ensured legislative requirements for children and young people in the care of the state were met. The college commenced operation with only 6 teaching staff and now offer education by working in unison with the Department of Families, Fairness and Housing and Department of Justice and Community Services across multiple facilities. Now a timeline, 31st of July 2012. Minister for Education formally established Parkville College at Parkville and Malmesbury Youth Justice Precinct in response to recommendations from the Ombudsman Report in October 2010. January 2013, Parkville College officially commenced operation at both Parkville and Malmesbury Youth Justice Precincts, delivering the Victorian Certificate of Applied Learning, VCAL, and the Victorian Certificate of Education, VCE. Term 1, 2014. Parkville College commenced operation at the Disability Forensic Assessment and Treatment Service, DFATS, facility in Fairfield, supporting people who displayed high-risk antisocial behaviour and who are at risk of or are already involved with the criminal justice system. Parkville College extended the Parkville campus, creating the Flexible Learning Centre. Term 2, 2014. Parkville College replaced the Bendigo Regional Institute of TAFE in the provision of Vocational Education and Training, VET, subjects at the Malmesbury campus. June 2014. Parkville College commenced the Education Justice Initiative, based at the Melbourne Children's Court, supporting young people appearing before the courts, linking them with educational pathways through liaison and advocacy with schools, alternative settings and training providers, and engagement with young people and their families. October 2014. Parkville College commenced operation at the Secure Welfare Services, SWS, providing education to children who are at substantial risk of harm and subject to a child protection order. January 2015. The Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre became the Malmesbury Youth Justice Precinct and Parkville College began teaching on the secure side at the commencement of Term 1. April 2017. As of April 4, the then Department of Justice and Regulation, DJR, assumed responsibility for the youth justice precincts at both Parkville and Malmesbury. The Department of Human and Health Services continues to be responsible for the Secure Welfare and the Disability Forensic Assessment and Treatment Service, DFATS, sites. Late 2017. Parkville College concluded delivering education at DFATS, as those at the site are not of a mandatory school age. Melbourne Polytechnic now provides academic support at DFATS. 2018, the transitions team was created and piloted at the Parkville campus to assist students leaving custody navigate their reintegration into society through supported pathways. The admissions team was created to properly assess incoming students and direct their journey in our unique setting. 2019, a transitions team was created at the Malmesbury campus. Term 1, 2020. The Elders Advisory Council, EAC, is established. The Flexible Learning Centre moves to Collingwood and is renamed O Street. The Consortium Campus is renamed Secure Care Services and O Street. Term 1, 2022, O Street moved to the heart of Fitzroy. Term 2, 2023, the Victorian Government announced that after almost 60 years of operation, it would be closing the Malmesbury Youth Justice Precinct at the end of 2023. This would mean the closure of the 9-year-old campus of Parkville College. Term 3, 2023. Cherry Creek Youth Justice Facility is opened by DJCS and Parkville College commenced operation in partnership with the Gordon TAFE. Term 4, 2023. The Malmesbury Youth Justice Precinct officially closed. In 2024, O Street Campus is officially closed. Term 1, 2025. Parkville College becomes a sole provider of education across all campuses.
Congratulations to Parkville College. You are our Great State School of the Week. That's all we've got time for today, but I'd like to thank everyone who has contributed this week, Andy and Maddie and Jeff. Apologies for not having Jean with us this week. We had a little bit of technical difficulty, but I'm working incredibly hard to overcome that and make sure we get a program to you. Hopefully in the coming weeks we'll be able to send out a big thank you to those who have pledged to the Dogs program for Radiothon. As Radiothon's still running, the station is still counting, and hopefully we'll reach our $300,000 target this year. It is still Radiothon time at 3CR, so if you are thinking you'd like to pledge a donation, you can go to the 3CR website at www.3cr.org.au/donate. That's www.3cr.org.au/donate. Or during business hours, you can call 03 9419 8377. That number is 03 9419 8377. If you'd like to find out more about the Dogs, you can visit our website at www.adogs.info. That's www.adogs.info. That's all we've got time for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Jean will be back next week. But from all of us here at the Dogs, from Jean, Andy, Jeff, Maddie, and myself, Dale, and all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize. Went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I
listening to 3CR, an apartheid free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.